And one of the pleasantest chapters I have to tell, I'm going to have some unpleasant ones to tell. One of the pleasantest chapters I have to tell is that the people that were fully satisfied with this formula, out of sympathy with those that were not dissatisfied, joined forces with them year after year to bring pressure on Parliament and other authorities to get the thing changed. This form originated in 1695. In 1722, another form was admitted by Parliament, which read, "I," and then John Smith or whatever the name is, "do solemnly, sincerely, and truly declare and affirm." No name of God. Affirm. This satisfied everybody on this point. And therefore, it was a slow evolution, you see, of dealing with this one disability, which friends, although tolerated otherwise, suffered a great deal under. This wasn't an aggressive act of the government, you see. It was merely that this was the traditional way of government performing its duty and requiring honesty, and the friends, by their own initiative, by their own scruple, got to be victims of it. A rather interesting development. However, this was only allowed in certain cases. Or shall I say that certain cases were excluded. Friends couldn't even affirm, certainly not, they couldn't swear, but they weren't allowed to affirm in criminal cases. The ones I spoke of in court were civil cases, weren't they? Property and so on. But in criminal cases, I don't know that friends often wanted to affirm or in a criminal case, but they couldn't. They were excluded from that. They could not hold office. That also required an oath, and the affirmation did not yet cover that. They could not enter the universities, Oxford and Cambridge. That also required an oath. And the result is we have no university-educated people, except those that were converted to Quakerism after they had sworn an oath and gotten into the university, down to about 1870. In fact, nonconformists couldn't get into these colleges much anyhow. Interesting fact, therefore, that university education in Great Britain in Quakerism is rather late compared with America, and not as extensive. That lack of extension, I guess, is economic in part.
You say it was until 1870?
1873, I think it was. You can get in there now. Rhodes Scholars from Haverford can do it. There was an interesting case of John Archdale, whom I may have mentioned before as one-time governor of North Carolina. He was elected to Parliament in 1698. But being a Quaker, he wouldn't take the oath of office when they were all being sworn in, and he wasn't allowed to affirm. And the result was he was disqualified, and they had to have a by-election to appoint a substitute for a man that had been elected and not served. The first Quaker to serve in Parliament was in 1833. One of the Pease family, P-E-A-S-E, became the first member of Parliament. There have been Quakers in Parliament practically ever since. Secondly, tithes. I think you understand what tithes are. They are a levy vested in the church, the local church, on farms, real estate in the area. Each area is in a parish. Each parish has a church. Each church has a vicar. And a small levy on each of those farms was by law approved for the use of the church, or at least largely for the use of the church. That's what's meant by a state-supported church in those days. This is the way the state financed the established church, parish by parish. The Quakers wouldn't pay these tithes. And this continued, yes?
Why didn't they pay? Was it because they supported clergy?
I'll read to you four reasons, may I? Which were adopted as late as 1830-something, when 1833 again, when the Quakers still objected to tithes. This objection was not removed as early even as the oath objection. Now here are four reasons. I'm just reading them out, Mr. Goodaleo, as I intended to anyhow. Civil government ought not to interfere by promoting one religion and interfering with conscience. Civil government, you see, they were, what happened was, if you didn't voluntarily give them to the church, or if the man that he sent, the curate sent to collect them, didn't pay, then the state took over. The sheriff, not the religious official, but the state, the local state, civil official. Their argument was, and this goes back before this state, that the civil government ought not to interfere by promoting one religion and interfering with conscience. Those are really two reasons, if you like. The Quakers couldn't conscientiously pay to this religion. A different kind of argument. Tithes were ordained in the Old Testament, but were annulled in the New. There happens to be a text in the book of Hebrews in the New Testament which could be quoted to that effect, that Christ had done away with the tithe. The religious background of tithes was supported by the Old Testament, where they were regular. The gospel was to be freely preached and not a trade. And, of course, you've run into that view before. And finally, this sounds more modern. Required payments are an infringement of personal liberty. Personal liberty, not civil, not religious liberty. Personal liberty. Well, what happened, of course, was that the Quakers wouldn't pay them, mostly. If they did pay them, the meeting got after them. If they didn't pay them, the government got after them. And the property levied, usually pretty small, I mean, they weren't a tremendous burden, if not paid, was then collected several times over by force, by sheriff's sale, or by appropriation. And all the Quaker records put down in two columns, the amount that was refused and the value of what was taken. And there's a great discrepancy between the first column and the second. This could be ruinous financially. And maybe one reason why there aren't as many Quaker farmers now as there were proportionally among the Valiant 60. You may remember that they were pretty much connected with the soil. He may call it cowardice, but I suppose a man who felt himself just unable to make a living with farming and these things would move into something else, something like school teaching, on which no levy was made, or indeed shopkeeping. In 1887, not with out of deference to the Quakers, but out of convenience, all the tithes in England were fused with the real estate tax and not designated separately for the church. And then the government, out of its general funds, you see, pays whatever it does pay for the maintenance of the Church of England up and down the country. And the friends didn't feel that they need to carry on their scruple any further. Here is a regular real estate tax, and there's no special designated part of it that goes for the support of the local church, and therefore they just paid. I'm not sure how devious was the ultimate diversion and calculation of what was paid to the church. I think it went into a national exchequer in general, and then it got lost. Just as you can't tell in our federal taxes just which dollar goes to this purpose or that purpose in our total federal budget. The trouble lasted on a little bit while, a little longer, though it had already gotten less. The thing had eased itself. For 100 years, between 1730 and 1830, it's been calculated that something like £700,000 was collected from friends. A third disability that I would speak of was in the area of military requirements. Now, there was no conscription, and therefore military requirements, even in wartime, were rather hit or miss, if you like, or rather casual. When the Navy needed some men, it just went on board a merchant ship and took some men. If a militia was raised, it was usually possible to pay your way out by hiring a substitute or paying a fine, and that was all right. But wherever the issue arose, of course, as it did during a war more than in peacetime, the Quakers got into trouble for it. From their own meeting, in fact, that's where we know, more than from the public records, because the meeting tells when friends didn't refuse to pay for a substitute in the militia, when they, for instance, when they didn't decline to put candles in their windows when a victory was declared. The public were expected to rejoice in this public way, time of victory. And if a friend did it, the meeting would get after him. If he didn't do it, the mob would get after him and break the windows in his house. So this shows that this kind of disability, their pacifism in a very casual way, intermittent way, was a disability that they weren't freed from. There were no provisions for conscientious objectors until 1916, when a draft law was first, a conscription law was first passed in England. Then there were some provisions, many of them not observed, and it didn't mean that the conscientious objector was entirely in a happy situation. And this means that right through this period, the Society of Friends bore a collective testimony against war and were known to. Never did they use in any official document a statement condoning war. They came awfully close to it once when they congratulated the king that a revolt had been put down, but they didn't take part in that putting down that revolt. Of course, they had other problems, namely how to behave during the Civil War, particularly in Ireland in 1698, when first one side and then the other roamed over the country and burned down the houses, and the Quakers were not supporting either side, but on the contrary, the Quakers were known to be so helpful to the victims of war that their houses usually were not burned down by either side. One great advantage was that 4 years before that war broke out, the yearly meeting in Ireland instructed all friends to destroy all firearms. And people coming to the Quaker houses and finding that the Quakers were not defending themselves even by having firearms in their houses, as most people did have, were understood to have this peaceful testimony. Well, this isn't all I want to say, but I'll have to stop here and the next time say something more. But this is merely a part of the external difference, and I'm speaking mainly from the legal situation, how public opinion changed toward the Quakers at this time is a different story.